Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ideas in writing.
Hello and welcome to episode 4, or maybe 5, depending on how you count, of Ideas in Writing. It's a podcast about words that are spoken, performed, published, and sometimes, actually quite often, actually, sung. And this time with a very special guest, the godfather of alternative comedy, Arthur Smith. I've met Arthur a few times, and he was very supportive of a play I wrote a few years ago. Nevertheless, I was a bit nervous. We talked about some of the stories that are in his newest book, 100 Things I Meant to Tell You. We talked about his love of walking. We mentioned Alfred Wainwright, who, fact check, died in 1991. So I was way out with my guess. His story, A Pennine Journey, the story of a long walk in 1938, was, I think, published in 1986. We also talked about Edinburgh and the festival that isn't happening, and near-death experiences of his audience members, and Arthur's singing career. We also mentioned Dadaism and comedy. Oh, and his Patreon appeal, so look out for him releasing new and old material. Like many entertainers, he needs your support. So do look out for that, and you can help him and others through Patreon and very similar appeals. Of course, we'd like you to support this podcast as well. And then things coming full circle, I ended up encouraging Arthur to write another play after his success with An Evening with Gary Lineker, which is a great play. Arthur is very knowledgeable about his literature, so I was nervous about speaking to him about writing. So much so that I completely forgot the premise of the podcast. I was going to offer the word play, for obvious reasons, I think, and Arthur later told me that he had chosen Pagoda. I asked him why, and he said, why not? So here we are. Play Pagoda with Arthur Smith. Hi, Arthur. How are you?
Yes, I'm hanging on in there. How are you, Philip?
Well, I'm all right. Yeah, it is getting a bit tedious, isn't it? Being kind of feeling that nothing happens. I mean, particularly at the moment, August, you must be missing Edinburgh.
Yes, I would have been in Edinburgh now. And I would have been, yes, and it would have been my friend's, well, it still is my friend Kirsty's birthday, who I do shows with up there.
Oh, right.
My show that I had originally planned to do got cancelled, but then I, at the last minute, I decided to do an outdoor walking tour show, which was all set up, and I'd sold most of the tickets, but then that one had to get cancelled too.
Why was that cancelled?
Well, you know, there were 30 pages of health and safety and regulations, and I could just see that I'd end up possibly in, you know, some one of my tour be infected, and I'd be the evil Londoner who brought it up to Scotland. I didn't want to do that, so reluctantly, I cancelled that one too. So, but yes, this is the first year I haven't been in Edinburgh since I think the mid 90s.
Wow,
and
I was gonna say it's not the first time you've approached or being close to killing somebody on a walking tour, is it?
Oh yes, now hang on, remind me of that story. That's for me.
I remember tour.
Yes, my late night tour, which I'm still vaguely thinking I might like do a Zoom version. I used to, this is in my book 100 Things I Meant to Tell You, I used to take a drunken crowd. I mean, I don't drink anymore, really, and my crowd are a bit less wild. But I used to have maybe 100, 150 people following me down the road at 3 o'clock in the morning, most of whom were drunk. And at one point I got a man to stand on this little balcony, which is just near the top of the Royal Mile, and sing Scotland the Brave with his top off. And then a woman shouted out, well, you should offer a woman. So I said, all right. And she got up, and they were both really drunk. And the next day, as I was walking by this spot, I suddenly looked behind this balcony and saw there was a 40-foot, 50-foot drop. And they were both drunk out of their head, standing there singing. I was too. I was up there. I mean, I could have caused the death of one or both of them and myself. And if I'd survived and one of them had fallen down and died, I would have carried that guilt with me for the rest of my life, which is what
it just made my blood run cold.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the woman in question and the man will maybe read it and say, oh, yeah, I remember that, because somewhere I've got a picture of her standing there with her top off, waving and shouting, with just in her bra and pants. And, it was – it's a little thing I like to do sometimes, gather together moments of – where things could have gone horribly wrong, but they didn't.
I think probably the internet's full of pictures like that, isn't it? if you search around for them. Actually, it reminds me of my dad. Your dad was he was in the Royal Artillery?
The Royal Sussex Regiment.
Just reminded me that my dad, who was in the Royal Artillery, he missed the war, but he was in Palestine, I think, and
duration of the war?
After the war, he joined, was called up in 45 or 46.
That was a good time to get called.
Yeah,
up.
He was very relieved. Yeah, yeah. But he was saying, talking about some friends of his who staggering back from the NCO's mess, very drunk, and then they lost one of their friends on the way, and they were hunting around for him, and he'd walked completely blind drunk into an empty swimming pool from the deep end.
Oh my goodness.
But he was fine. He was fast asleep on the bottom.
Presumably not for too long. I'm guessing they dragged him up. So many close shaves that you don't consider. Maybe I'll be killed by a bus after this.
Oh no, you're not going out, are you?
I probably won't. Yeah, no, not now. I've said that.
Yeah, are you getting out? I mean, you love walking, don't you?
Yes, I do. Although I haven't done as much as usual in recent times for obvious reasons. But yes, I went up Box Hill the other day, and then I went with some friends and walked around the lavender fields.
All right.
And mostly, though, I'm walking around Tooting Common and Wandsworth Common, and occasionally Clapham Common.
Yes, that's where you can be found.
Yeah. If in doubt, comb around Tooting Common. I'll be sat under a tree somewhere.
Is that something you've always done, you've always enjoyed?
Yes, I think when I was very lucky at school, the school I went to, which was a grammar school, a state school, owned a little kind of long shed in a little place in the Lake District. So from the age of 13 or something, I used to go up on school trips to this place called Braithwaite in the Lake District, and we'd go off walking up all the mountains of the Lake District. And my mother always liked walking as well. So it was, and then when I was 16, I walked the Pennine Way.
And oh, wow.
When I was in my 50s, with my brother, I walked the coast to coast. Although, annoyingly now, I've got a condition called claudication, which means my legs ache more than they used to. I certainly don't go as fast as I used to or as far.
Is that a condition? I think that's just age, isn't it? It just happens to everyone.
No, it doesn't happen to everyone. Because it means my legs ache after I've done the 300 yards and I have to slow down a little bit before I can start.
I see.
I mean, it's not too debilitating. Yes, no, it is not everyone. Although it's true, obviously, I'm probably not as fit as I was when I was 21.
No, probably. Yeah. On balance.
I always think it's hard for, if you're a sports person or a dancer or something, well, not necessarily a dancer, but a sport. If you're a sports person, your career's kind of done by the time you're in your early 30s. If that,
Whereas well,
comedy,
well,
you
I
can
suppose,
keep going. Yeah, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as long as you can stand up or sit down, I suppose.
As long as you
can
remember what you're meant to be saying or have something interesting or funny to say.
Yeah, do you find that, no, I'm not going to leap straight onto how you write comedy, because I still want to talk about walking. Did you read the Wainwright books?
Oh, yes. I was a big fan of Wainwright. I've still got one upstairs that I got given as a prize for something at school.
Oh, really?
Yes, with those pictures and all the roots and the he was clearly I think he was probably a bit old the rest of the time, but he was when he was in his element walking up in the mountains, he was extraordinary the way he so religiously went through every walk and wrote them all down and drew.
Yeah,
because if you think about it, rambling's a relatively recent thing. Prior to the Romantics, Wordsworth and Coleridge, who brought up the idea of walking for pleasure. Prior to that, you probably might have walked a long way, but that was to get to the market or go and pick your donkey up from its MOT.
Donkey? That was a wealthy family. I often think that when you find some of these little kind of wooded tracks across the hills and so on, you think this was someone's commute once.
It's been there hundreds of years probably. You see those paths that are carved out in the woods, aren't they? And so many millions of steps have been walked over them. They've slowly gone into a little trench of their own.
I read Wainwright's book about the Pennine Way, which I think was about the last to be published, actually, because I think he originally wrote it and never published it. I think it was so it was kind of 1938-39 and towards the end of it towards the end of it he writes something about the sort of rumblings coming from Europe and kind of I hope there won't be a war.
Really?
Yeah.
When did he die, Wainwright, then?
Oh, gosh.
I mean,
70s?
Was
it something? I don't know.
So
he wasn't
in the war then? He was in the rambling regiment?
No. I don't know, actually. No, I don't think he was. No, I think he was too old at that stage, perhaps, but to be called up straight away. But I don't know.
Well, somebody will look at that.
Yeah, somebody will. But yeah, it was quite sweet because, of course, he set off without any kind of plan and no accommodation. And,
it's quite romantic. I've always been quite fascinated by travellers and tramps or whatever you choose to call them, or hobos. Yeah. There's a rather good book out about it recently by a guy called Ian Cutler. And about, because I've always been wondered, maybe I'll end up just sort of wandering from one place to another. And for some people, it became a choice of lifestyles. never to be pinned down, or anyone really knows where you are, and you make friends along the way, and and blag your next dinner. Or I think I have a rather over romanticized view of it, but I applaud Wainwright for doing that, and I followed in his footsteps. What, 40 years later, when I did the Pennine Way. I always remember that the last two nights, I think, one we spent in a shelter, a kind of it's like an old train carriage at the top of a mountain somewhere. But we still had like 30 miles to go. And then I think we camped overnight a couple of times, and we were winging it a bit. And it was a great feeling when we finally walked into Kirk Yetholm and I got my O-level results.
All right, yeah, yeah. Which were good?
Yeah, they were. I can't really remember now, but yeah, I passed them all and did pretty well in most of them.
It's it was just the idea that, you know, kind of set off with his leather shoes and his Paris tweed jacket, and I don't know. Yeah. I think he might have had a map, and that was it. And he just knock on people's doors.
What did he carry? Did he have? Because I know the Romantics used to carry like briefcases or that you know.
Really.
They wouldn't have anything on. I don't think the rucksack was invented then, was it?
Well, I'm sure knapsacks were invented. Yeah, they were pre-First World War, weren't they? But
So you
have done a bit of that, because you don't drive, do you?
No. I sailed through my driving test. That's why I failed it. That's a gag of mine for years. No, I don't drive. And funnily enough, there's a friend of mine who produced a program on Radio 4 years ago called Poets Don't Drive, which apparently is largely true. Although I think female poets do, but male poets, none of them can drive, apparently.
That's a good point, actually, because Ian McMillan goes everywhere by train, doesn't he?
I don't think Roger McGough drives. I think probably Wendy Coke does.
Right.
I'm not sure about Simon Armitage. We should find out.
Yes. But it's already been done on Radio 4, so there's no point.
A long time ago, yeah. So the fact that I think it was Wendy Cope said that it was male poets, and she had an acronym for them, which was TUMPS, which is Totally Useless Male Poets. Not that I'm putting myself up with Simon Armitage and whatnot, but I've always taste for poetry.
Yeah, you have. You're very a very literary person, aren't you?
Well, words is what I deal in.
Yeah, it was one of the reasons I was quite apprehensive about interviewing you, because although I run a bookshop, I don't actually read many of them. And you read a lot.
I don't read as much as I used to be honest. Although I've just been reading a series, lots of short stories by Saki, which I'm really enjoying. Yes, I like to read, but sometimes I fail and end up watching, you know, true crime on the telly or something.
Yeah, well, obviously, yeah. Yeah, but going back to the walking thing, you used to hitchhike to gigs, didn't you?
Oh yes, I used to hitchhike everywhere when I was in my 20s. I couldn't afford the train. Quite often then, in those days, there weren't night buses or anything in London, so I used to hitch home from parties. And yeah, I'd hitchhike to gigs. I was a very proficient hitchhiker, and it was quite common then. If you went to the start of the M1 at Hendon or something, there'd be a row of 10 people standing there, waiting their turn in line to get picked up to go up the motorway. Hardly anyone does it anymore, I suspect, partly because you can get mega buses, which I think are quite cheap, but also because people are now terrified they're going to be picked up and shot and whatnot, although they probably wouldn't. I have hitchhiked in a couple of times in recent years when I had to, and both times worked out fine.
Yeah. I read, because I think you also mentioned, did you mention it in the book? Maybe not. Maybe it's in another interview. You mentioned about tweeting for a lift.
That is in the book. Yeah. Yeah. Tweet hitching I have quite a few followers on Twitter. So twice I've said, can anyone give me a lift from there to there? And a guy did. I mean, I was often offered to pay petrol, but he didn't even ask for it. And he was actually Central Line Gary, I called him. He worked for the Central Line in London, and he was just a really charming man. And we had a lovely conversation. And if you're listening to this, Central Line Gary, I'll see you out on the road again soon. But yes, I've done it a couple of times at Christmas or something when I needed to get somewhere and obviously there were no trains, or I was at a gig and it finished too late for the last train back. Or so tweet hitching, maybe that's the way forward.
Maybe it is, yeah. I suppose that's basically what Uber is anyway, isn't it?
yeah, it's kind of.
You do have to pay them, that's true. But you don't generally do that now. I mean, you go everywhere by first class train now, don't you?
Well, no, not first class. No, I used to a bit, or certainly at weekends. I'll often pay the weekend supplement, but my funds are not quite what they were. Occasionally, sorry, I kicked the microphone now. Bloody microphone, come here. I still hitchhike very rarely and I get trains, but I love a train. I really love trains.
I do, yeah.
Far more than any other form of transportation, because you can see the landscape as you're going through it in a reasonable way, but swift enough that it's exciting.
Yeah.
And whereas in a car...
That trip up to Edinburgh is always a trip, isn't it?
Especially the bit from North Berwick. Through to Edinburgh, right along the coast there, is the most beautiful bit of railway. There's a few of them. There's one down south I rather like. It goes from Exeter along the bottom of the coast there. It's rather lovely. And Scarborough. Yeah. And I think there's some lovely ones in Scotland, though. I've not done enough of those.
Yeah. Well, I would have thought you were the perfect person for one of those travelogue gigs, train journeys that everyone else seems to do them.
You're right. If anyone's listening, and I do actually love trains and get them. I expect I'm not convinced that, Paul Tillo probably drives everywhere. I don't know if he really loves
Chris
trains.
Chris Tarrant,
I bet. Well, he doesn't love trains as much as me. I don't think that's possible.
No.
Arthur Smith on the train. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Do you remember that program? There used to be a program I used to love on the television, a very bland program in a way, called Swiss Railway Journeys. And it was just loads of endless shots and nice trains going through the Alps with a bit of library music attached to it. It wasn't really much more than that.
Really? I don't remember that at all, no. But again, that's the sort of thing that you get on YouTube now. I mean, you literally get... I know there's a road in Scotland. I think it's called something like the Atlantic 500.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a road that goes from the west coast up to the far north. And there's a guy who's done it all on motorbike with a video camera.
Oh, yeah.
And it is quite interesting.
I know, I've done that
before.
Definitely
waste quite a lot of time.
Well, I've put into YouTube driving across Siberia or something.
Yeah.
And there's always someone who's done something like that, stuck a camera on their car. And you just see all these different landscapes and other worlds. And
It is quite fascinating. I think I fondly imagine that when I'm very, very old and unable to go anywhere, that's what I'll be doing. I'll just be looking at YouTube.
Yeah, well, going anywhere is right out of fashion anyway.
It is at the moment.
Apart from the pandemic, I think it's generally agreed that air travel is not great for the environment.
So, yes, as I say, used to hitchhike to your gigs. But I was going to ask you how you got started in comedy, how you started making a living at comedy.
Yes, well, that was in my late 20s. I'd spent a lot of time in comedy prior to then. I went with a group of good friends up to the Edinburgh Festival in 1977, the year that we finished university at East Anglia University in Norwich, and we put on a show and it was quite successful. And then we put on another one the next year and the next year. And then they were beginning to be quite successful. And I still had other jobs then, in the end, as a teacher of English to foreign students. But then, so we were still doing this review show, although that was a bit old fashioned. And then the stand-up boom in London started in the early 80s. And I took to doing, well, I was in a double act first with my friend Phil, and then I went solo. And then there were more and more gigs building up, and I was getting a bit of attention off the radio and telly. So I remember distinctly at 29, I obviously remember distinctly, I jacked in the other stuff and went full time into as an entertainer, as a kind of song and dance man. And until now, I haven't considered doing other work other than show business ever since.
So when you talk about sort of comedy, stand-up comedy taking off in London, did you go and see comedy before you...
Yes, I went to the comic strip and I saw Alexi Sale and Rick Mayall and Aid Edmondson and Pauline Melville, and I was stunned by how modern it felt, particularly Rick Mayall, particularly Alexi. And he was talking about now, he was talking about Thatcher and he was talking about the world, and whereas I had been a bit stuck in this rather old-fashioned mode. And I saw the possibilities of talking about the world. And this was a time, I think it's no coincidence, that alternative comedy, or whatever it was, began at the same time as Mrs. Thatcher became Prime Minister. And there was really, the country was very divided then, in a way, feels a bit like that now. But you were either with Thatcher or you were against her. And all the old school comedians were all Thatcherites, or most of them, and they were delivering old jokes in sparkly jackets, whereas we were busting on the stage. There was a little bit of punk in it too, and talking about new subjects and trying new ways of doing comedy that wasn't just jokes, or at least it was our own jokes, or observation comedy, or there was a whole new series of impulses coming into comedy then, and it was exciting.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing about comedy then is that you were looking at, you kind of had comedy heroes who were the same age as you.
I remember being very, I was very excited when Rick Mayall came to one of my shows. And, the young ones made a big impact on the world of television. So then I started getting gigs on the telly a bit sometimes. It was all.
How did that happen? I didn't mean to inflect surprise in my voice then when I said how did that happen? Because I mean, nowadays comedians will go to Edinburgh having rehearsed the show to death and then assume that somebody's going to pick them up for a radio or TV or something.
That's the hope. Well, in Edinburgh, I made a few contacts, but I think it was more, I was doing a lot of comparing around London then. I was on every other week at the Comedy Store in Leicester Square, as it was then, and Jonglers, which had just opened this big club in Battersea. And I was, I was kind of the man as the MC then, so people inevitably would come and see me. And then I ended up, I remember after a show I'd done in Edinburgh, a chap who I'd met briefly, worked for LWT, came up and said, we want you to be in this new show, First Exposure. I was sort of very excited. I said, how long do you want me to do? He said, we want you to present it.
Wow.
So that was a big thing I did in the mid-80s.
I suppose, because I suppose if you're comparing, you've got that, that performance thing that you're kind of holding the show together and you're not just doing your 5 or 10 minutes.
Yes, you're like the host of a party as an MC in a way. You introduce people to each other and, if one act's gone down not very well, you try and liven them up again. And if one's gone really, really well, then you slow it down a bit for the next act. Mm. There's a whole rhythm to MCing that it came to me relatively naturally. I actually was MCing when I very rarely did solo spots at that time. And I only had about 20 minutes material, whereas I used to be winging it as an MC. Yeah. So usually it's the other way around. But some people are naturally good at MCing. They've got some people, they're, their character may not be correct for presenting the world to the show.
Were you conscious of kind of, because you say you were winging it, but were you conscious of kind of writing yourself on the stage, or were you?
Yes, the key is in stand-up particularly is to find your own voice, is to find the person that you are most naturally good at being on stage, yeah. Which may be you or some version of you. There's quite a good story I seem to recall where Jack D was starting out around then, and he used to come on, and he was quite bouncy in a way you can't imagine now. Yeah. But then he decided to give up comedy. This is how I understand the story. And so he had a few more gigs, but he went and did them with a kind of this more type of attitude, at which point he started getting the laughs. And he realised that was the voice that was best suited to him for comedy. A lot of comedians, when they start out, they sound a bit like another comedian. But you have to find your own voice and your own type of material and the thing that you're most comfortable with on stage. And that can take a long time.
Yeah. And I think there's so many comedians around now that they're kind of inevitably sound like someone else, as you say, certainly as they start off.
Yes, well, it's true. When I was doing all that MCing in London in the early 80s, there were only about 15 of us comedians.
Yeah.
But now, more or less, everyone in the world is, it would seem.
Yeah.
There certainly are loads and loads of them.
Yeah. You know?
And when we were doing it then, it wasn't really for the money, or there didn't seem to be much avenue on TV in the early days.
Yeah.
Whereas now, I think often people, it's just a step towards some other thing they want to do.
Yeah. It's a very different... Do you think if you were starting out in comedy now that you'd be doing it in the same way, or you would have progressed in the same way?
Well, who knows? It's a hypothetical. If I was starting out now and I'm 65, I'd have to do a lot of material, which I do even now, but about being old, I think. One of the things that's changed about comedy is people talk a lot more about their own sadnesses or problems or excitements.
Yeah.
Oh, is that your siren or mine going
by? I think it's yours.
Yeah, there's always loads going by here.
Yeah.
I do love a siren because it's going to some disaster that's nothing to do with me. Well, I hope not.
As long as it's moving away, not being loud.
Yeah. Oh, hello, who's that at the door? Oh, police.
Yeah.
Where was I? Last thing I remember is doing my O-levels, as an officer sale used to say.
But, we're talking about the starting out in comedy today.
Yes.
I'm interested in the sort of the kind of business of it, because it strikes me that certainly when you started out, there was as you say, not many comedians in that sort of circuit.
Yes.
And you genuinely did know most of them, didn't you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And particularly in Edinburgh, this time of year, if most comedians were doing Edinburgh, and you could all meet down at the Gilded Balloon on late at night on the show. And similarly in London, lots of comedians used to go to the Comedy Store for the late show, which didn't begin till midnight. So you'd come off stage and see a load of other comedians all propping up the bar, drinking too much.
Yeah.
Whereas, yes, now, I mean, there are hundreds of comedy clubs. Oh, there were, of course. You know, it's a difficult time for the comedy, live comedy, and there's not much help coming their way. And I gather lots of comedy clubs are in danger of closing down. And so,
yeah, I'm sure.
It's probably, you know, if you were looking to go into a new line of work, you probably wouldn't choose stand-up comedy at the moment. But then, in a way, you don't choose stand-up comedy. It chooses you to some extent.
Yeah.
I think I was always a child who quite liked showing off to make people like me. And comedy was my métier for doing it.
But it's not always comedy, is it? I mean, you do poetry in your...
Yes, I love to recite poems during the course of my act. And I, as you said earlier on, I have a literary dimension, and I've always I've always thought there was a connection between poetry and humour and gags even. It's a small story with very carefully chosen words, which is not so much the case with a novel or different forms or a play, whereas stand-up comedy is a series of little stories. And a poem is a little story, and again, with very carefully chosen words. You notice in stand-up sometimes that if you have a phrase, but if you just slightly rephrase it, it gets a big laugh. But if you use it and leave the sentence as it started, it doesn't get any laugh at all. And I think that's the care that poetry has for language. Every word counts in a poem.
So when you're on stage, I don't know how much you are. You feel you're working from a script, and in a sense, reciting it.
Yeah, to some extent you are. Although the audience have to give the illusion that you're just thinking it up as you're going along, and that's the suspension of disbelief that you do in comedy, that they've never said this before, and this is an entirely new thought, which is sometimes the case, of course. But mostly comedians have some kind of... I have quite a lot of material at the back of my mind that I might pull in at any moment. But I have a vague structure, depending how long I'm doing. But I usually have an idea of the structure before I go on. Talking of which, I'm doing a show on Saturday at Southwark Cathedral.
Oh, yeah.
Outside, there's a new statue of Shakespeare appearing. And I'm doing 20 minutes at the end, and I'm currently desperately trying to think how I'm going to do 20 minutes or half an hour even, which is all Shakespearean material. I can do a bit.
Yeah.
Torquay or not Torquay, that is not Wrexham. Wigan tis Newcastle upon Tyne to Suffolk the Hastings and Harrow of outrageous Morecambe, or to take Barnes against the sea at Peebles by opposing Elton, etc. I've got a few other bits. And I did do a version of Hamlet once at the festival.
How was that?
Well, it went very well in the end. At first, it was a bit of a disaster the first time I did it.
Why was that?
It was a lot of wrong ideas and gags that didn't come off and monologue and soliloquies that I didn't quite do right. But then I managed to get it right at Edinburgh. And I remember that was an ecstatic feeling coming off stage after it went really well. And then I slipped on a banana skin outside the back of the venue and fell on my ass.
Literally?
Literally. And I never misuse the word literally. I literally slipped on a banana skin and fell over, which I don't think anyone's ever done apart from the old films.
But there must be there's a sort of symmetry about...
Exactly.
After Hamlet.
Yeah, to tremendous applause, then falling on your ass and twisting your ankle on a banana skin. There was that definitely was a high point in my Edinburgh career, as was doing Hamlet, because I was quite interested. Hamlet is an extraordinary character. He's this introverted, clever, scared, maybe, with mental problems, depressed. He's got a reason to act, but he can't bring himself to do it. And it was the first depiction of depression, I think, ever really in the theatre was Hamlet. And because normally the Prince of Hamlet will be out waving his sword around, killing people in previous to that. And in fact, this is a bit I might be doing at the Southwark Cathedral on Saturday. I'll tell the story about Mad Frankie Fraser. Are you familiar with him, Philip?
No.
He was a kind of gangster who worked for the Crays and Richardson's. He was an enforcer, and he used to beat people up for a living, essentially, and then subsequently made a career out of talking about it. He had a book out at the time about all the people he'd beaten up, and he'd spent 30 years in prison or something. And I took him out for lunch. There was me and him and Sally Phillips, who was my Ophelia. And he said, "Hello, Arthur." he made me sound like Prince Charles. And I bought him lunch, and he said, "Well, what you got me here for, Arthur?" I said, "Well, I'm doing Hamlet." And Frankie said, "Well, you bought lunch. I'll do him for you if you like."
Yeah.
He did come and see the show in the end as well. I was a bit worried that he was going to subsequently do me after.
Yeah. Well, you took him out, so, you know, that's a...
That's right. Yeah, I was on the right. I mean, that was really the end of my association with the London underworld, I have to say.
Well, you have to say that, don't you?
Yeah, it's true. I don't want them knowing anything else, but obviously I run the mafia from Balham.
Yeah. Actually, I noticed this thing about, you know, the nightmare of Balham that you appropriated.
Yes, I am the self-proclaimed. I live in Balham, which, for those of you who don't know, is a inner city suburb, I suppose you'd call it, of just south between Clapham and Tooting. And I have declared myself mayor some years ago, so I'm self-proclaimed mayor. I mean, there isn't a real one because that's actually Wandsworth, which is the borough we're in. But so I am the mayor of Balham. I'm the nightmare. I don't do days. And I, you know, we're building a wall around Balham to keep the people of Clapham out. And I like to make little jokes vaguely related to the news as it is. I've just decided not to close Balham Post Office.
Right. Way.
And yeah, and I'm thinking of putting a big statue of me up in Sainsbury's car park. I'm a bit of a dictator in this. I'm kind of like a cross between, I don't know, Mao Zedong and Neil Kinnock.
That's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah. I'm sure that the internet, that being as it is, actually has you down as the mayor of Balham.
Oh, yeah,
for,
I'm sure.
For real.
If you Googled mayor of Balham, I have no doubt that my name alone would come up, or at least I'd be top of the list. I have actually, someone gave me a sort of gold chain made out of plastic, obviously. So I've got that upstairs, and a T-shirt. Someone gave me a mayor of Balham T-shirt as well. So, I don't want anyone else being mayor, so I have all the other people. People say that I've got some deal going with the Russians, but I haven't, I can assure you. But from now on, it's Balamsky. These are sort of ludicrous games I play in my head as mayor of Balham.
Yeah.
Got a song. Do you want to hear my song? This is the song when I proclaimed myself mayor of Balham. I stood in the Waitrose car park and sang, "I am the mayor of Balham, oh yes I bloody am. I am the mayor of Balham, I bloody, bloody am." And I wrote the lyrics for that.
Really?
Yeah, quite proud of that.
Yeah.
I sometimes get audiences to sing along with that.
Do they have to change the words? Because they can't all be the mayor of Balham.
Well, no, they're really celebrating me, aren't they? Their supreme leader, El Presidente.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Yes, could be like North Korea, couldn't you? Could all...
Yeah, there's a touch of that about my mayorship.
Yeah.
Mayoralty.
Yeah, it's a mayoralty, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
You do like to sing, don't you, actually?
Yes. Yes, that's not always the case for people who like to hear me sing, but no, I consider myself the third best Leonard Cohen tribute act in South London, because I've done a couple of shows called Arthur Smith Sings Leonard Cohen, in which I first chose the title just because I thought it seemed to be like the grimmest evening of entertainment imaginable, so that it's like the worst possible title for a comedy show. But actually I do love Leonard Cohen's songs, and I found that actually I could sing them not too bad with the right accompaniment. And I built little stories around them. And so I've done two of those. Maybe I'll do another one day. But Leonard is no longer with us, sad to say. Although he went out on a high in my mind. Talk about a sense of timing. He died the day before Donald Trump won the presidency. great time.
That was good time. Very good time. I only just watched on YouTube Arthur Smith sings Andy Williams.
Oh, yeah. Is that on YouTube?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that was my first.
It's on Granada TV, apparently.
That's right. Although the live version was better, and I've got a film of that somewhere. Yes, oh, yeah. That was my, that again, that started out as a joke, Arthur Smith sings Andy Williams. I had no intention of singing Andy Williams, but then as Edinburgh grew nearer, and in the end I did sing a bit of Andy Williams with Tony Hawks, the writer and comedian and golfer. And but I made it all about this character that I was very interested in, a guy called Arthur Craven, who was a sort of pre-Dadaist figure who lived a most ridiculous life, and yeah, in some senses personified Dadaism, which was always something I was quite interested in. I don't know if you know about Dadaism, Phil.
I don't know. I was going to ask you about that, because you do reference it a bit, and it's another reason why I was a bit nervous about talking to you, because I know nothing about it.
It was kind of born around the same time as surrealism, or at least in a sense, it gave birth to surrealism. And it started as a ridiculous little show called the Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich in 1915, when, of course, Zurich was neutral, but the rest of Europe was ablaze with people killing each other and dying in the First World War. And I think it was a reaction against all the classicism and grand ideas that had brought us to this. And Dadaism refused all that and was kind of stupid and didn't take anything seriously and was interested, in repetition or in dreams. And that's how it ended up as surrealism.
Right.
But the things I used to do in these Dada shows still make me laugh, the idea of them. You know, they had three people come on and all tell the same joke at the same time, but each in different languages, or like ludicrous dance things that were, in a sense, they were making a comment on the ludicrous idea that order is possible. But they were also funny, I think, looking back.
I don't know much about it, but is that sort of does it speak about something that you find attractive in comedy, that it has something to say rather than being soulless?
I don't mind if it's just someone falling on their ass. That's funny. That's something to say, in a sense. Every squeal of laughter is a moment of release from the madness of the world. I always think laughter, it's the closest we ever come to sounding like our old ancestors, chimpanzees. There you are. You see, you've just done one, Phil.
No, that was actually a chimpanzee. Sorry. It's normally in the garage. But
laughter is the one true metaphysical consolation, as Nietzsche nearly said, but not quite. But I think bringing laughter to people, I'm very lucky to be able to have that job, and I hope I continue to have it for a while. And Dadaism, in a sense, was the same impulse.
Yeah, although I guess it wasn't dependent on laughs, was it? And if you're a comedian, you go in a club.
I'm sure it did get a lot of laughs. It's true, though. Yeah, that's the one thing about comedy. It's the one art form, if you want to call it that, where your success is measured instantly and audibly. Whereas, you can be an opera singer not doing very well, and then you don't really know till no one really claps much at the end.
Yeah.
But with laughter, if people are laughing lots, then that's it. You're doing your job. And if they're not, then you're not.
Yeah. And it's so, what's the worst you've ever died then? On stage.
I like to ask other comedians that, and there's some horrendous stories out there. There was the time when a man poured a pint of his own urine over me.
Right.
That wasn't very nice. I think actually, though, the worst probably was a corporate gig I once did in front of a load of car salesmen. And frankly, you know, I don't drive and I'm not that interested in cars. So I had a, my car material was really not what they wanted, in as far as I was slagging cars off largely.
Yeah.
And I just went down to a very big silence. And then you have to do that. I had to do the walk from backstage to go out and get the train home or hitchhike home. And I had to walk past them all, and I could see them looking at me thinking, what the hell was he doing here? That was a miserable one.
Yeah.
And then there's been a few where I did a show called the Pissed Up Chat Show. And the first version of that I did at the Udderbelly on the South Bank, was just because the idea was I'd have guests that were drunk, whereas I'd be sober, and I used to give them a breathalyzer at the start to make sure they were drunk enough to to be eligible. But then, of course, obviously, drunks aren't always necessarily entertaining. They can be sometimes, because I did a run of it at Edinburgh, and some drunks were hugely entertaining, but frankly, mostly they aren't. And I hadn't really worked out what I was doing, and the whole thing was a disaster. And I don't think I've played the Udderbelly since.
Was it a long run? Did you have to?
Well, the Udderbelly was just a one-off, but in Edinburgh, in Edinburgh, I did 10 or 11, 12 shows or something. Yeah. And some of those are quite good. I mean, the audience knew that it was liable to be unpredictable, to say the least.
Yeah, that concept's still working though, isn't it, in Edinburgh? Because there's still the pissed up Shakespeare and.
Yes, that's what I think I started a bit of a trend in a way, because there was always those drunk people doing history on the telly, wasn't there? And I had this idea as well, I'd do stoned, because I did really early on in my career when I was playing Jonglers in the Comedy Store. I used to go on stage with a joint and hand it to whoever in the audience wanted it, and then spend the rest of the evening going back to see if that person was laughing more, and therefore if he just gave everyone a joint, we wouldn't need comedians, was my thesis. But it's hard to think now, where obviously a cigarette would be you get arrested for, so actually handing out a joint, looking back on it, seems like a very strange thing to have been doing. I obviously wouldn't do it now.
So Edinburgh isn't happening. So
no.
What are you doing? What are you doing with your time?
Well,
being busy?
I did another show in Edinburgh a couple of years ago called Mindlessness, which was, and part of my thesis of mindlessness was CBA, which is can't be arsed fullness. And I must admit, quite good at being lazy and not doing much. But having said that, yes, I've been trying to work out how to do Zoom gigs and that kind of thing, and I'm trying to set up a Patreon. I'm not sure how you do it, where I'm going to generate lots of material and put out old clips and whatnot.
Oh, good.
And I feel I should be writing a novel or a play, obviously, but the times are so fluid and unknown what lies ahead that I find it hard to knuckle down. Well, that's my excuse anyway.
No, I feel the same. It's sort of, there was initially there was a sense of this is not going to last very long.
Yeah.
We'll just go with the flow. And then there was a lot of people producing a lot of stuff online, learning how to bake or hang glide or something. And, or at the same time. And then you feel guilty for not doing
as much. Yes, I know. I'm a pre-techie man, and I'm not very good with all those things, but I recognise that. And I'm not entirely convinced I want to go to a Zoom gig.
Really. No.
It's just not the same, is it, as being. I did do an outdoor show at the Tring Festival, or at Tring in Hertfordshire, is it, a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And they'd set up a stage and it was outdoors and socially distanced and everything, and they washed a microphone between every comedian. And I did feel, it felt wonderful to be doing it again, even if you felt a bit, you didn't know quite what you were doing initially, or does that joke still work? How do I do that? What should I say about all this? But actually, there was a great atmosphere. The audience were really really welcoming and pleased to be there. And so it felt actually really rather good. So I'm hoping I'm going to do some more outdoor shows. I might do some tours of Balham, maybe.
Yeah. Well, you know, you definitely get an audience. Yeah. You definitely get an audience. Even if they were all 2 meters apart and you had this long.
But that doesn't matter if you've got sort of 20 or so and you take them around the common or up to Sainsbury's car park and relive these great moments of mine as mayor.
Do you use a megaphone?
Well, I do. I used to in the old days when there was 200 people up the Royal Mile. In fact, the time I got arrested, they said you're arrested for breach of the peace and possession of a megaphone. But I do actually have a megaphone, and I don't know quite if I'd need it or not if I was doing an outdoor tour. I shall have to experience that. It's not quite the same, obviously, a megaphone, but if there's people up the back and you don't want to go hoarse, then maybe that's the way forward.
Or again, maybe there's some kind of technical solution that if everyone's got their mobile phones and their earphones in.
Yeah, that's true.
And you've got a little.
Well, little I suppose if I've got a little speaker and a microphone or something. Yeah. I mean, the trouble is, I'm rubbish at all at anything that, you know, anything normal, really. I'm rubbish with things. So I'd need someone to help me sort that out. So if anyone's listening and wants to help sort out how to monetize my alternative tour of Balham, then apply here.
If just remind me, if I ever did a stand-up, I had a line that how much I hated inanimate objects.
And, oh, really? What's the line?
Well, that was the beginning of the line. You know, I haven't developed it much, but I was going to then go on to say, and I hate animals as well. And I'm not that keen on people. So,
you'd be going for the sort of misanthrope stand-up.
I think I would, but I think I probably would.
Well, there might be a way forward, Phil. It's not a great time to start out, but you never know.
No, they'd definitely be socially distanced, wouldn't they? The two people who came to see me.
Yeah, I remember going to a show once in Edinburgh years ago where, I didn't go. I heard about it. There was a guy who wasn't doing, you know, he was not selling many tickets, as is often the case. And he was doing his show and there were two people in the audience, a couple watching him, which must have been a bit embarrassing all around. And then they left. So he presumably was going, oh, man, another thing. And then they walked out and there he was just standing in front of nobody. And I often wondered if you finished the show anyway.
I was the only person in the audience for a show last year at Edinburgh.
Were you? Well, how did that feel?
Yeah. Very awkward.
Yeah.
Very awkward, yeah.
They did the show.
Two people on stage. They did
Oh, really? Oh, there were twice as many on stage as in the audience. Yeah.
And I even bought them a drink afterwards.
Very noble of you, Phil. Well done. What was the show?
I can't remember the title. I did tweet about it afterwards because I thought, they need more people.
Well, the first time we ever did Edinburgh, we had, five in the audience. One of whom was my brother with his two friends, and one was someone else we knew.
Yeah.
It's quite common in Edinburgh to play in front of nobody.
Yeah, I guess so.
Especially when you're starting out.
I guess so. But no, I think what you should be doing is writing another play.
Yeah, you're right. I should be. Although even there you think, well, are plays going to ever come back again? You know, they've cancelled all the panto season and whatnot.
Yeah. But I mean, have in mind it might be a television play or something, but it's I really enjoyed An Evening with Gary Lineker.
Well, thank you for that, which I co-wrote with Chris England. I've never had a hit like that since, really. I suppose maybe Grumpy Old Men in a different way. I was lucky to have done that. And all right, I'm going to write another play, Phil. I'm starting as soon as we end here.
All right, do you want me to go then?
Well spotted. I've got to work out this Shakespeare gig that I was talking about.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I've got to write a play as well.
Yeah, you haven't got long. Just get on with it.
This is the longest I've sat down and talked to someone for ages.
Is it?
My partner and I, but she's upstairs writing all the time.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a pleasure, Phil.
Yeah, it has. Thank you. I know you mentioned your book right at the top, but we ought to mention it, 100 Things I Meant to Tell You.
That's right, yes. Available in Fields Bookshop.
Yeah, it's great. I love it. I'd read quite a few of them before, but because I think, have they been in The Guardian or some?
I'd extracted from things I'd written in the past, yeah.
Yeah, but it's nice. And, you talk about your mum and
my mother.
Was in Tunbridge. And,
Who has dementia now and is in a home, but actually she's in a miles better place now than she was when she was in Tunbridge living alone.
Yeah.
Feeling the dementia coming on. Now she doesn't really know she's got it, so she's quite jolly, you know, and they're lovely to her. The carers are fabulous people.
Yeah. But I guess you haven't seen her for a while, so.
No, the last time I did see her, there had to be a fence between us, which was awkward, and it felt a bit like she was in a cage or I was in a cage or something. And she's arrived at the point now where she doesn't know who I am.
Yeah.
So I don't feel too bad about not going to see her at the moment. I can't wait to go back and take her out for a little walk around the grounds because she was a great rambler in her day. And she still loves to walk, even though she's 90 and obviously doesn't go as fast as she used to. But, I'm looking forward to seeing my mother.
Good, good. Well, I hope that happens soon, and I hope you get out and about soon as well.
Yeah.
And I hope your Southwark gig goes okay.
I hope so too, forsooth.
Yes.
Exit. I have got a bear costume as well, so I'm taking that. Exit pursued by a bear.
Have fun. Thank you for talking to us, and take care.
Thank you very much, Phil, and may your next guest be even more brilliant than me.
Oh, I doubt that's going to happen.
That's what you tell all the guests.
Actually, it might be Ian McMillan, you never know.
Oh, yeah, he's a great man. Yeah, good on him.
All right, thanks.
Cheers, then. Bye, Philip.
Bye-bye. So there you go. That was the lovely Arthur Smith, self-appointed nightmare of Balham, and an all-round good guy. So call in to Mr. Books or go online to www.mrbooks.co.uk if you'd like a copy of Arthur's 100 Things I Meant to Tell You. We can offer you a discount on that if you mention the podcast during August and September. You would have heard a hint about a possible future guest, Ian McMillan, but he hasn't finalised yet. But before then, I'm hoping we can get to speak to the very positive and inspiring Giles Paley-Phillip. But again, we just need to pin him down. But keep checking back at our website for new episodes. Or even better, subscribe on whatever platform you found us. And you can donate there too through Acast. Ideas in Writing is supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of independent, inspiring and imaginative gifts, books and conversation, including an exclusive range of book-related and Mr. Books-inspired T-shirts, so have a look at those on the website. Whatever you buy from us, including books, of course, helps to keep an independent bookshop open. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. You just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.